Hey guys, this is And the Writer Is, and I'm your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special events, or buy some of our merchandise, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. Oh, and if you enjoy this podcast, please rate us on iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast listening site is. We really appreciate that effort.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. This week's writer is a songwriting community staple. She defies the rules of the industry. She's helped define not only some of the biggest pop stars' careers, but also some of the biggest writers' careers. She's co-written some of the biggest radio songs in the past decade, and yet is humble and generous. From the great San Fernando Valley, this songwriter makes me laugh, makes me think, and makes me hope. And the writer is my fellow theater dork, Lindy Robbins. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we've been talking for the last like hour because that's this is what happens when we're together. So I guess we should kind of, instead of having people jump into our conversation, let's start from the beginning. So you were born,
as far as I know, possibly hatched.
Right, exactly.
I was born.
You're an LA kid. Did you grow up in music?
I'm a Valley girl, an actual, authentic, genuine Valley girl, yeah. And I did not grow up in music. My father was a musician, and not a professional musician, but had an incredible passion for music.
So what did he play?
He played piano, and like I sang when I was three at my cousin's bar mitzvah, was like my singing debut, or maybe I was five.
Do you remember it?
No, I don't remember much, but no. But I remember singing with my father and him teaching me like all the old classics, and that's why I have a big love for musical theater and classic songs and Rodgers and Hammerstein and Hart and Gershwin. And
so were you doing theater all that was the focus when you were
no
little?
It was just the focus of the songs that I knew were the American classic pop.
Mm-hmm.
The
songbook.
Yeah,
the Great American Songbook.
Thank you. The Great American Songbook. Yeah. And musicals, because that was just his life. So I grew up singing and loving musicals. But I also grew up, you know, with Elton John and Joni Mitchell and the Beatles. And that was kind of the stuff I gravitated more towards.
Was that something that did he have an opinion towards, you know, what popular music was versus, I mean, I just don't know what that was like, because I do know what that was like, because I was going to say my parents, when they listened to the music I listened to, and it was, you know, Nirvana and Pearl Jam and whatnot, they're like, this is terrible.
I didn't really like buy music then. I mean, he bought like Elton John and like Billy Joel and the Beatles and Harry Nilsson. And I remember hearing that. But I guess maybe, I don't know, I didn't really play the songs for him at that point. He was, you know, so passionate about teaching me, you know, classic songs and Gershwin and Hammerstein. And also, I mean, I should probably say that my parents got divorced when I was 11. So like he wasn't, I guess, around as much when I was a teenager. So that's probably a big part of that, why that didn't happen.
So you go through musical theater stuff. You're probably doing all these plays when you were younger too, right?
I did plays, and then I did musical theater for a little bit in LA, like when I
When you're in high school.
Yeah. But high school, we didn't do a musical my year, which was like really, really sad. But I did musicals, I tried to do LA theater. I did a little bit of LA theater, and then I moved to New York trying to do theater.
Okay, so you go to New York, and how old are you when you're in New York?
Like in my 20s.
So you get to live in the greatest city in the world.
Oh, it's still like when I think back on it, I had like no money. And I mean, I was living in like this tiny walk up with a shower in the kitchen in Little Italy. And for 6 years, and I didn't have a whole lot to do because I didn't have a songwriting career yet. And it's still some of the happiest years in my life.
What was your career though? What were you doing? How do you pay for life in New York?
Daddy helped a lot.
Uh-huh.
I don't even know how I did it. I mean, my first professional jobs, and I don't even really like to admit this because it was, I did like four editions of songs for the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. And I'm a little bit embarrassed about, I know, it's very bizarre. I'm a little embarrassed about it because I'm such an animal activist now. But at the time, I just was like, oh my God, like I just got hired to write these songs. Now they came back to me years later and I was like, there's no amount of money that you could pay me that I would do it. But I mean, I was in my 20s and it was like this incredible opportunity. And I also have a very strange—
Wait, so they just find you out of nowhere and they're hey lady, you wanna write songs?
This is what happened. My career has been very strange because when I was in New York and I was singing, trying to act, couldn't get arrested. I was trying to audition for musical theater, couldn't get arrested, was in a singing group. You know, I was like in the cabaret theater world, and I got to know like Adam Gettle, who's a Tony Award winning composer, and Stephen Schwartz was a good friend of mine.
Wow.
I knew Liza Minnelli, I knew Stephen Sondheim through just like that was the crowd that I knew.
Did you guys hang out, like have dinner?
Yeah, with Liza, Adam, I dated him for a while. And I mean, these are the people I wrote songs with. I wrote songs with Stephen Schwartz. I used to write a lyric on a page. Like when I first started writing songs, I would write a lyric and just like hand it to them. And that's the way that it's done in that world. And then they would like, and I wrote some great songs. Like John Bacchino is an amazing composer. Yeah, they would do all, you know, and I always heard melodies. But at that point, I was like, that wasn't the way that it was done. I mean, Adam and I, both songs that we wrote, Audrey McDonald recorded and, you know, Stephen performed, you know, we performed those songs and Liza hired me to write a song. This is insane. I was hired to write Michael Feinstein and I wrote songs for Bruce Valanche. For Harvey Fierstein, I have the weirdest career ever.
So I've gone backwards.
I've gone upside down.
This is so crazy. Were you writing there? So you're writing the music for these theatrical the lyrics for these theatrical stars' solo careers?
They were like Bruce Valanche did a movie. So Michael Feinstein and I.
Most of our listeners have no idea who these people are. Give oh yeah, they were in this show kind of thing.
No, but, well, I mean, Bruce Valanche, you know, has been writing the Oscars, like the joke for the, how do you explain Bruce Valanche?
That's fine.
Like,
that works.
I know they won't know who he is. Harvey Fierstein, you know, was a big Broadway playwright star and Torch Song Trilogy. People know, I think, who Liza is.
I mean, Stephen Schwartz is like one of the richest songwriters in history.
Yeah, I know. I mean, these were like the people that I knew. And Stephen was going through a dry spell, if you can imagine. This was before Wicked.
Wow.
And he'd written Pippin and Godspell and all that when he was really young. But I always wanted to write pop, and pop is my passion. But those were the people that I met through trying to do theater and the vocal group that I was in. Yeah, so I was singing, acting, and these are the people that I met, but I always wanted to write pop songs. Like, pop was always the thing I was most passionate about. I just had no idea I didn't know anybody. And
were you making a living at writing at that point?
Well, my overhead, my total monthly overhead was about $500 a month.
Living in New York?
My apartment was $300, and then they raised it to $400. I had no utilities, no cell phone, no car. So
you were in a closet in the middle of like, I loved you were living in the smallest room.
I was living, you know, a 91 Grand Street between Mott and Mulberry. Yeah. It had a shower in the kitchen, 5-floor walk up. And
the kitchen.
I loved it. It was insane. Like, because I came from the valley.
I washed my armpits.
Oh my God. I loved it. I would walk. I mean, this is before Nolita and before it was all like, this was like in the 90s. So I would walk, you know, every day I'd be walking to Soho or the East Village, or I would just, I love it. I had a boyfriend, a serious boyfriend there. And I absolutely loved those years in New York. But I don't know how, I mean, because I did the circus and then I would get hired sometimes to do special material. And I would still sing a little bit and daddy.
Yeah.
I'd be like, dad, what do you need, kid? And envelopes of cash would arrive.
Perfect.
And I just got by, but I was known as like, I was the brokest.
We've talked about this in other things, in other episodes, where somehow when you're the brokest, there's always still dinner and drinks and parties and, you know, you're out till 3 a.m. and when you have zero money, you still somehow manage to find...
You just get by.
Yeah, you just get by.
Or like you eat before you go to dinner, you know, you make your spaghetti, like my thing was like noodles and ragu, you know, spaghetti sauce. And then you're like, oh yeah, I already ate. So then you can just kind of, you know, and I had generous friends or, I mean, Adam Gettle, he used to hire me to like, he used to have photo shoots or at his loft and he would like hire me to go sit in his loft where I would like work on lyrics and people could have like stolen his piano.
Yeah.
I would have noticed.
Yeah. So how do you go from writing lyrics with that kind of music to starting to pursue the songwriting world? I mean, I saw the Audra McDonald credit as sort of the first thing that shows up on you know, Wikipedia, which I thought was interesting. And that comes in, this is like 1998. So how do you get a song to her? And are you like the only writer on that?
I mean, oh, I forgot to mention something. And I got a publishing deal from Rodgers and Hammerstein during that period for very little money. I forgot because I just remembered that actually. And as I was trying to be an actress and a singer and slam, 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 never could get a break, I had like 5 songs. And so Adam, my friend, was like, I'll get you I can get you an interview there, but, and the lady's like, I'll meet you, but we don't really, you know, sign songwriters. And then she said, I want to sign you. So it was like this tiny deal and I never got any cuts from it, but that was enough money. That was a lot of money if you think about what my overhead was.
That's incredible.
It's like 15 grand or something.
I mean, that's like getting signed to Lennon and McCartney.
It was amazing. And they wanted to, at that point, I thought my songs were pop. When I listen back to them now, I mean, they weren't pop at all.
Were they super theatrical?
They were super like art songy.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, like way too, I guess theatrical is a good way to put it.
Did you want to be the artist?
No.
When did you know that? Because here you are singing and then you're also writing, but yet you don't want to release your own music?
At that point in my life, I wanted to like be in musical theater. I wanted to be a performer, but I never wanted to be a recording artist. Never.
You just happen to be good at writing lyrics, so on the side.
Yeah, and then I just started writing lyrics, and I was looking for songs like to perform for myself, like funny songs and stuff like that. Like as a performer, like cabaret, more than wanting to get a record deal.
Sure,
I never was trying to get a record deal, and but it's important to say that all this time, my passion was always, you know, Joni Mitchell and Lauryn Nero and the Beatles and just pop music.
Sure.
Then it was like so much, I missed so much because I was listening to a lot of theater for a long time. So, and at that point, and I'm not going to name names, but there was a pretty big songwriting community in New York City. But I could not get a co-write. I could not get arrested. I tried so hard, like for years, you know, before I moved back here in 1997. So towards like 94, 95, 96, with some of these people, and I could not get a chance. Nobody would write with me. Finally, there's a girl named Tanya Lea who, you know, was a very, very talented country writer. And we wrote a few songs, which is part of like the story of how it happened.
Did you feel discriminated against? Was there like a misogyny situation?
No.
Why did they?
I think it was more like, which I think is so funny because that's why I think my career is so strange. at that, and it's only really recently that I've opened up about the way that I started, because for so many years they'd be like, you're too theatrical. She's a theatrical writer. She's a cabaret writer. So I wasn't thought of as a pop writer. So they were like, she's not a pop writer. So I think it's kind of funny that, like, if you think about the hits that I've had in the last few years, it's, you kind of think about that people would start with the pop and end up more in the other world. Yeah. It's how it usually goes. And then they're writing shows and stuff, but it's gone the complete...
The exact opposite.
Yeah, the exact opposite. And I hope someday to write a musical, because I feel like I have that ability, but I just, nobody, they just didn't think of me that way. And they, when they heard the songs that I had, they said, these songs are theatrical and she's not a pop writer. And
did you ever train to do music?
No, nothing, zero.
So it was all just, I'm a fan of this and learning from the actual albums. And
learning from just doing and not even realizing that I don't know, I just wrote lyrics and then, you know, and I would be very aggressive with, you know, this guy, John Bacchino, who's an incredible composer, and with Adam and Stephen Schwartz, I mean, I would be like, here's a cassette, you know, or here's a lyric, like, check out my lyric, like, can we write together? But those were the only people that I knew, and like I said, the pop people, and there was a big pop community there. I couldn't get a chance. And, but I bring up Tanya because that's part of my story. I just... You know, I'm not.
She was in Nashville, or she?
No, she was in New York, but she used to go to Nashville a lot. Yeah, she's still an incredible writer. And I saw her at, they used to do the songwriting circle. I think they still do at the, it's a famous club on Bleecker. And I saw her, and I just had this strong, I've had like some psychic things in my life. I saw her, and I'm like, I have to write with her. And I literally like stalked her. And we wrote some songs together, and I had a similar experience of like, I want to write pop songs. I want to move back to LA and write pop songs. I don't know anybody. I don't know what to do. And interestingly enough, at the time, I was at BMI. I switched to ASCAP when I moved here. And ASCAP paid performances for the circus, but BMI didn't. So I was going to BMI. I mean, I don't know if this is relevant, but asking, you know, can you help? You know, can you match it? And one day I got like a check. It was $12,000 check. And at that point in my life, it might as well have been $1.2 million.
Yeah.
And then I literally was laying in my little bed with my no closet in Little Italy. And I heard, and I was like, should I move to LA? I don't know anybody. And I heard a voice literally said to me, move to LA, just like that. And I sat up in my bed and I said, okay. And then I got the $12,000 check.
There's your musical.
And I know, $12,000 check.
You don't take that epiphany of just like, all right, no. I'm on a journey. Let's go.
And I just did it. You know, it was
how soon after that did you go to LA?
Pretty quickly,
like and within a month.
Well, I just did a big post on Facebook because it was 20 years ago on June 11th.
Oh,
it was 20
I saw
years.
That.
Yeah, and I mean, and I had
we moved within a year of each other.
That's so funny.
There you go.
Well, I had made some trips to LA, and Marsha Malamut was a big writer at the time. She had given me a shot. I had written a couple songs with people, but I really didn't know anybody here. I had no idea how I was going to break in. And it's important to say, I think a lot of the top liners now that break in, a lot of them have really great voices. And it's a big plus. I can sing. I have a decent voice, but I never had that voice. So it was always harder.
But of our guests that tend to be that side of songwriting... By the way, Desmond Child made me say that I can't say top liner anymore. So I shook on it, and I'm going to be a man of my word. So that side of songwriting, we had, you know, Evan, who's not, you know, an A-list singer. We have Jay Cash, not an A-list singer. You know, you look at the best writers in the world, and so many of them aren't A-list singers. They're just really good writers. Those are totally different jobs.
You're right. And I think... Sometimes you have to be a better writer if you're not, because I think there are some people that get in the door because they have incredible voices and it's a plus.
Yeah.
That's not to say they're not incredible writers as well. But
did you find you needed to write with somebody who could translate it better
later
in recording?
When I first started, you know, we used to hire demo singers.
Right.
But I moved back to LA with nothing. I mean, I had that $12,000. It was enough to get a car and an apartment. And as soon as I moved back, there was like a songwriting magazine, and I saw this entry for this Unisong Music Bridges Song Contest. And I said, on a cassette, and it was a deadline, one song, this song called The Love We Never Made with Tanya Lea, the song we'd written in New York. And I sent it in thinking nothing of it. And then Alan Roy Scott, who's still a friend of mine, called me and said, not only did we win Best Country Song, but I won the whole contest.
Wow.
And it was a very big contest because the prize was going to Ireland for a songwriting week with like major songwriters, Irish and ones from LA and Nashville and like people like Rodney Crowell, and writing for a week and then doing it like a concert in Dublin. And that really is that I met, I mean, the Rowena Gillespie, she ended up signing me to Universal. People were like, and I didn't even know at that point that I could like, the way that we write songs now, I'd never done it. And I was like from room to room to room and I could just do it. Like, you know.
So this is the LA life. This is, you know, you had already released your, you're kind of done writing music for Audra McDonald at that point, right? And
yes.
Now the goal is like, what do we do with these future songs, right? You're at this point, you're like, okay, you're walking to a room. Who are you writing for, I guess, is my question. Because before you had like, I need to write lyrics knowing how Stephen Schwartz writes musicals. I need to write lyrics that he might respond to. You know, you move out here. Who's your audience?
Well, first of all, it's important to say that I discovered around this time that the melodies I was hearing with the lyrics were good. So that's when I started doing melody and lyric, which I'm proud to say top liner. I happen to like the expression top liner. So, sorry.
All right, then I'll shake hands and we'll always call it a top liner.
I like it.
Just a fair weather.
I like top liner.
No, I think that, look, there's something very specific about it and very clear.
That's why I like it. That, say lyrics. Well, what's interesting is because of this camp and the people that I was doing a lot of R&B music, I say R&B because it really was R&B at the time. And that was my first like co-writes and were in R&B, and I even had this guy who I don't remember his name say, I want to manage you and take me to a meeting at Big John's office. This was still, I think, 1998, who said, I want to sign you right now. And I didn't, and I always sort of wonder what would have happened and slightly regret that decision. But it was because I was being loyal to this woman, Rowena Gillespie, at PolyGram at the time, and I felt like she'd helped me since the camp, and so I'm very loyal.
Are you loyal to a fault?
Maybe, but it's just who I am. I'll never change that. Yeah. So I'll always remember that moment. And so my first, I wouldn't say cuts, because at that point we had cuts, but they didn't come out. Actually, I had a single on Monica. That was probably one of my first big things, but then it didn't go.
Right.
But my first things were like all like in the R&B world.
Wow.
And it was
That's way opposite.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But that was always... In my heart, I always was like a pop girl. I've always gone where the opportunities are.
Do you think that's because you were raised in LA versus New York? That had you been raised in New York, you would naturally be a theater girl and then...
I don't know. I just know that I've always been obsessed, you know, it's just what I feel like I do or I love or... And it's also where the opportunities are. Like, I also realize that cabaret pays nothing, and pop music, you can actually make a living. But it's not even that. It's following my heart and just doing...
Well, there's also money at that time in the music business where they can take a risk, they can sign a new writer who has no cuts and give them kind of significant money. I mean, probably more than the $12,000 you got.
That I missed all that. I missed the years of where I just missed it, where, you know, you were on a Backstreet Boys record and made millions from... the sales, the album tracks. I never had like a huge publishing deal. When I got my publishing deal, I really didn't have cuts. It was not a lot of money, and I had to live on it, and I had a release commitment. So the first check I got, which was not that much, had to last me for 3 years. I mean, I still had no money and was in terrible debt. And then I had thought, okay, so I can either live off credit cards and go into debt or go get like a waitress job or something, and I just... decided to let go into debt.
That's my personal favorite quote that I ever had was when I was foreclosing on my house, or they were foreclosing on my house, and I was saying like, I'd rather sell my condo to live my dream than to sell my dream to live in my condo.
Wow. I love that.
And there was just that moment of, if they're going to take it, they're going to kick me out. That's fine. But like, what else am I going to do? I mean, I literally have zero training in anything other than music at that time, you know?
Oh,
I now have training, but I don't.
I have no, I can't, I literally don't know how to do anything else. It's like,
So you have this deal, it's through Universal.
So it was Polygram at the time, and then it became Universal. That was my first deal that lasted a long time.
But the big hit, the first real big hit is the Nick Lachey one, right?
No.
Or is there one before that?
The first big hit was Incomplete by the Backstreet Boys.
Oh, that's before Nick Lachey.
Yes.
Oh,
and okay. And so this was like, so
you didn't
7 years.
Oh, I guess that's the tail end of them selling.
Right, because I did get a couple big cuts. I had like an Anastasia cut and like Clay Aiken. I had some big cuts where records were selling like 5 million, but I missed the 30 millions and the 20 millions. I missed that. And then I didn't have singles. I used to call myself the Hitless Wonder.
Yeah.
Because I was getting a nice amount of cuts then, but I couldn't get a single. And the Incomplete was it was an accidental single. Because I had written it with Dan Muccola and Jess Cates, and we were all kind of unknown. And Teresa LaBarra Whites is amazing because she'll always let the producer produce a song. So Dan produced a song, and the label wanted like a known entity. They wanted Max or Diane Warren or somebody to have the single. And apparently it got leaked. I hope this is true because this is what I was told, to radio, and it just sort of exploded on its own and just became the single of its own accord.
Amazing.
And that was the first one, and that was life-changing for me.
Yeah.
And I still love that song. I have to say, some of our songs we cringe now, but that one is still like, Incomplete.
We were playing it so loud in our house yesterday because I was playing, and I hear my wife and, you know, the next room over singing along, being like, wait, why are you listening to that? I was like, Lindy wrote this. She goes, no way. It's incredible.
I'm still very, very proud of that song. The big, and Jess Cates, I was writing partners. Jess Cates was my writing partner for like 10 years.
Just the two of you?
We were sort of a team.
Wow.
Then we met E-Man, and that was a big, big chapter.
That's, you meet Jess when you first move out here?
No. I think it was about, maybe it was 2000 or something.
Uh-huh.
This was like, been doing the R&B stuff, and then I met Jess, and we just really, through Daryl Brown, who's I love and is amazing, and we just clicked. And then, you know, this is my thing. I just started saying, okay, this is where we're going today. This is where we're going tomorrow. Yeah. I just set up all of our sessions, and we had...
So all those cuts are basically you two together.
Us two together. Well, Incomplete, and then we started working with E-Man. We met E-Man. And I remember meeting E-Man, and I had this weird like, oh, like I know you or something, or I meant to ride with you. And
yeah, because you're, you know, that's obviously before you're about to have some crazy runs with that guy. So.
Oh, yeah. But I discovered him, and I've said this a million times, I discovered E-Man. And then Teresa said, I want you and Jess to work with Nick Lachey. Who do you want to bring in? And I was like, I want to give this guy E-Man a shot. And
how did you hear his music that you were like, I'm going to go?
I hadn't heard his music. And at this point, I was just really open. I'll always be open to like trying people. And we had been introduced. There was another writer who we'd written with who said, do you want to work with this guy, E-Man? Like, what producer? And I'm like, yeah. And then when I worked with them, we just completely, completely clicked.
Yeah.
And
that's like 2006 or so, right? 2005?
It might have been like around 2005. I know he said it was just been like 11 or 12 years. So yeah, it was around that time. It was after Incomplete. So yeah.
This is after, because after you have a Backstreet Boys single, kind of still in their prime-ish years, you're still like, I can imagine you could get any producer, right?
Not yet. No, it wasn't. Because I think it wasn't the same as it is now where everybody knows who wrote it and everybody... Or what? I don't know why, but it wasn't like the doors were flying open. It was an incredible moment for me, and it definitely changed my life, but it just wasn't that moment yet.
Right.
And then we wrote What's Left of Me with E-Man. So, and it's so funny how I've gone through different career things of like, well, this is what she writes. Like, at that point, it was like, she writes big boy band ballads, which I thought was so funny because I knew that I'd come from everything else that I'd come from. But this has happened many times in my career, and now I think finally people are confusing. Like, I guess she just writes like
writes
a
songs.
Lot of different stuff. Yeah, writes songs.
You go from theater to R&B to huge big.
But I was a closet theater writer because I really had to downplay that for a long time.
Right.
So I finally came out as a cabaret theater.
It's really funny.
Being my start.
Between Nick Lachey and Skyscraper, there's like a lot of cuts that happen, but the first time I wasn't in the music industry or wasn't in the pop side of the music industry. I was in a band during all the 2000s. And right when I start getting into songwriting, Skyscraper happens. But I don't know if there's anything else I should talk about before we get to Skyscraper.
I mean, there were singles. There was, I started working with Toby Gad, who became a very big, and still is a big co-writer of mine. And I remember, again, like begging him. Pete Ganbarg introduced us at the ASCAP Awards. He's like, you should write with Toby. And Toby's like, here's my card. And I like stalked him. And came to New York, and the first song we wrote, Selena cut, and then Jordan Sparks cut the second song, and that, I had like another single on Demi called Here We Go Again. I mean, that might have been after. No, it was before. So there was some singles. There was a Brie Larson single, which is so crazy. She ended up being this Oscar-winning actress. And a lot of cuts. A lot more. There was another Backstreet single, Inconsolable, which is embarrassing. I know, incomplete, inconsolable. It was an accident. It was never supposed to be Backstreet Boys. But I had like 9 songs on that record.
Sure.
So there was a point with E-Man. This was before Evan, the Evan E-Man era. This was with Jess Gates, where, you know, we had a lot of stuff on Backstreet Boys. We had, you know, a lot of American Idol stuff.
When you were saying the 10 years with one co-writer, was it a sort of a divorce at the end of it? Or was it just sort of like, you know what? I met Toby, I'm going to write with Toby. I met E-Man, I'm going to write with E-Man.
Yeah, this has
sort
been
of a natural
even, there switch. Derek Bramble was even, and Damon Sharp were actually even before Jess, as I'm thinking. It was always a natural thing. Like, I had my first Anastasia and Faith Hill was with Derek, and then with Damon, we had Monica, and we had some big cuts. But no, it really was just, I think he moved back to Nashville, and, you know, we're still great friends. There was never a falling out for me. Moving in and out of new groups of people, it's just been just sort of like, then, you know, you get a little tapped out, or sometimes you've been working with each other for so long, and then something feels fresh. I've always liked, that's why I also travel a great deal writing, because I like to mix it up, and I like new people and new energy. I always have. So no, I think Jess moved back to Nashville. He had kids and just decided that was a better place for him to live. And he was very into worship music and different kinds of things. And I also think that was an issue too, because, you know, I'm kind of a dirty girl. So I wanted to get into some other stuff.
It's really funny.
Oh, I know, but it's true. People say I have studio Tourette's. I can be pretty bad. And
that's awesome.
I'm trying to think if that's maybe when E-Man and I started working with Evan. I think that was the next big thing.
But that's after Skyscraper, isn't it?
Okay, Skyscraper. So Skyscraper
song,
was
the
a
reason
Toby.
Why I bring up that song is because to me, I think that's you know, top 10 to 20 songs that people still kind of reference in meetings where they're like, well, we need something like Skyscraper. We need that moment. And that thing, to me, it's not your biggest song on radio or anything like that, but that song seems to be maybe the most identifiable by name of anything, maybe, you know, as big as any song of anyone we've talked to. It feels like it has that kind of presence.
Yeah, I feel like that song's become like a little bit iconic, and it's also important of like all the things that I've seen where people were like, this song saved my life, or I didn't throw up today because of this song, or I didn't harm myself because of this song, which is the most important reason to write songs. But I think
why did you write that song?
Okay, and this goes back to Toby Gad. I met Toby Gad in New York, and our first two songs got cut, so then he started to give me shots at things, and he had me flown out to work with Curly, an artist named Curly. So we wrote Skyscraper for Curly. And the real truth of it is that I had the word skyscraper in my head as an interesting, and this almost never has happened to me because I'm a very much get my titles in the room. I walked in there and said, I have an idea to write a song called Skyscraper. And Toby said, I don't like the title. It doesn't sing. And Curly was drawing pictures and thinking about her childhood. And then it just got very emotional. He just started playing that thing in the piano and it just kind of poured out. The song just happened. And I mean, when I think about it, yeah, it's based on things that I've been through. It's based on things that Curly's been through. Toby's been through like unbelievable stuff. I mean, you'll have to have him here. Of like lean years, like you can't believe. So it was written from a very, very real place. But the inspiration was one of the only times in my career that I had a title and just a concept of like
what that meant. Did you know it was great?
I knew it was great. And I never... Incomplete was the same. Going back to Incomplete, that song took a couple years. It didn't take a couple years, but the A&R person at the time passed on it. And I knew it so strongly about that song. And when they got a new A&R person, I was like, resend it. And with Skyscraper, first Curly did it, and then she got dropped. And I just said, I know there's something so special about this song. And then Jordan Sparks got the song. Wow. And it just wasn't a great fit at that time because I think she's incredible. I've had a lot of cuts with Jordan. Didn't make it and was like sitting around and there were some people that wanted to cut it that we said no to. And then I didn't even know that Ben Groff had played it for John Lind. And at the time I was like Demi Lovato because at the time she was like the pop Disney pop princess. I didn't know she was going through rehab and these incredible things. So this was like 2 years later. And then when I saw the video and heard her version of the song, I just like cried my eyes out. It was like that song had been written for her and for that moment. And I think that's an important part about why the song is what it is. It's because it spoke to what she had been through and what I'd been through, what we'd all been through.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Right. It seemed to open up. It seemed like that was the beginning of consistency for you, where you're starting to get songs that annually that just kind of become part of that Great American Songbook. I mean, it's really short after that, maybe even that same year that Hot Shell Ray comes out, right? The next year, I think, with Tonight Tonight, which is an unknown band on a label at the time that was kind of struggling. And
took a year.
And that song ends up becoming... I remember finding out when it had just passed Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Wow.
For... I was with, I think, E-Man and Evan, your co-writers on Evan Bogart, who we had on this. But I'm pretty sure it passed Sitting on the Dock of the Bay for performances, total performances,
wow.
Or something crazy.
I didn't even know that. It was crazy if that's true.
It was some crazy thing like that, you know? And it's, tell me about the process of a song from nothing to blowing up so big that, you know, it almost inevitably makes the band a one-hit wonder because it's impossible to follow that up. So, I mean, that song is just like, did you know at that time that song is we have an A-list song. We can choose who we have cut it. I mean, what's the process of writing that song and how it gets to where it gets?
Well, that's when Jess moved back and that began sort of a two-year, like, pretty exclusive with E-Man and Evan. And there was where we were just right. That Those lyrics are very much Evan and I. I mean, Hot Show Ray came in later and then they changed some stuff and made it their own. But at the time, the three of us, like those silly kind of lyrics, it was that it was It Girl for Jason Derulo and it was Classic, which also broke MKTO. So we were doing these really clever, funny, and then of course, she does that. But it was a period of time I didn't know. Like, I did not know that Tonight Tonight. Like, when it started and we were, like, laughing, we're like, it got one spin, you know. And then
you know the whole song just from that.
Yeah, but we just didn't see. We were like, it's an unknown band. But it took a year. I mean, I think it went number one, like, on Hot AC. It took a year. Classic also, I think, took, like, a year. So we just had this magic period where just everything we were writing was like singles, and Evan and I had this lyrical style that was still, I think, very unique. Like, those songs were a unique group of songs that were very, very different.
Were you patient during that year? Do you follow charts? Are you following this for a year?
I think I got so burnt out on following charts because you get so obsessed and you can't control it. And then I started to realize that it comes in really high, and then the research hasn't happened, and then it drops down, and then you know, I used to just have anxiety attacks for weeks watching the charts. And I think I finally came to a point where it's like, this is not healthy. I mean, I still would, and it's not as easy as it is now where you know, you can look at MediaBase and really, really see or exactly all the different things. But it was an incredible run. And like, then it got me out of the big ballads. Like, and I still love running big ballads, by the way, but think about Incomplete, What's Left of Me, Skyscraper. Now you're into It Girl and Classic and Tonight Tonight and these like quirky funny pop songs.
Right. Well, I mean, speaking of pop stuff, you then end up having, you know, you get some One Direction cuts right in the beginning before they really blow up, you know. One of the things that I like about your discography is that you're always in first. Like, you always seem to be with these people before.
Not always. I feel like other people...
You got to Demi before people got to Demi. You got to Selena before people got to Selena. And you got to One Direction. You know, I mean, is that just coincidence with all those?
I think for me, I've been lucky with the producers. I think I've met amazing producers who have brought me into opportunities. Steve Robson, we have a bite up, but I did several of the One Direction songs. They were with Toby and with Steve Robson.
Were you flying to love Steve? Were you flying to London?
Well, what happened was the first ones were with Toby. There were two with Toby where they were just like these kids that came to Toby's and they were like this band. I don't even know if they were signed. Nobody knew what was going to happen. Taken that was on the first record, I think it was like the demo that they put in the record. Toby was just like, oh, there's this boy band. You want to come and write? Like, nobody had any idea.
So you didn't, when One Direction, were you in the room with them?
Yeah, it was all of them. And I still think about the $1 million I could have made because they were all shirtless out by the pool at Toby's. I was like, why didn't I snap that picture?
TMZ.
Oh my God. Loved it. And they were adorable and they were great. And they would, you know, come in and say, we like this, we don't like that. They had ideas. But then I'm trying to think when I first met Steve, because I've written a lot of songs with Steve. And
you had a lot of songs with One Direction.
I had, I think, four, because then Steve and I had two.
Crazy.
And we also had 5 Seconds of Summer. That was the first like co-write I think that they had. They were in London like with shivering because they like didn't bring jackets and it was winter. And Steve and I wrote the first group of songs with them, and that was Steve again. So like, I think I was really fortunate to have producers that would bring me into these amazing situations and opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, it's just an amazing thing to watch. See, when you're with an artist and no one knows who they are, and then see them become a household name.
Oh, is unbelievable!
Shocking to watch,
and
that.
Great people too, yeah. Which is nice and talented.
You then end up for another sort of phase in your career. If you go for the next one, you then end up kind of with some EDM stuff because you have. Really, Selena Gomez's Slowdown is kind of more EDM in a way.
Well, that.
And then you end up with the Get a Dangerous, which is a whole other thing. But let's start with the, you know, Slowdown. It becomes a kind of Selena's first real radio hit, isn't it? Like, not Disney radio, but like, that was like a real, maybe the first real pop radio.
Yeah,
hit.
It might have been. It might have been. No, I think it was I forget what it was called, but it was right around that time. It was one of the first. Maybe it was the first. Well, that brings us into the Julia Michaels period, where there was like a couple of years. This was sort of after the E-Man Evan. And of course, I still work with E-Man and Evan, but it just sort of shifted into a new thing. And I have a friend named Jolene Bell, who's a wonderful writer, and she had developed and worked with Julia for years. And I heard Julia's voice, and I was just like, this girl's incredible. I heard her on a demo, and I was like, can I use her on a demo? And then I was like, do you mind if I co-write her? I mean, I really have to give a shout out to Jolene, because she spent, you know, I think 4 or 5 years really developing her, and she had her some of her first opportunities with Jolene. But then I heard her and just said, I just had a feeling. I need to write with this girl. And so the first song we wrote, I think, the second song we wrote, Demi Cut. It was called Firestarter. And then the second one was Slow Down. And that's how that EDM stuff happened, because of Julia's voice. So we were getting a lot of opportunities where she was singing. Like, we had some semi-big EDM hits, just because our thing was just get into the room and just like write, you know, to a track or whatever. And then they would hear her voice. It was a song called Surrender and Invincible and... it was just this whole period of Julia.
Your method as a writer had to evolve so much to go from the Backstreet Boys style of sort of discipline and syllables and all that stuff.
I've never, ever been a disciplined syllables person, ever.
So how did you get to... Well, that would make sense. I mean, for Julia, that was so important for her to be herself. Were you encouraging her to do
always,
that then?
I've always closed my eyes and just seen what came out. I'm the most unprepared writer. That's why Skyscraper was so unique. But it was only the word. The song came from the chords and the feeling and the emotion. I've always been coming from emotion. I've never been about syllables or technical or the chorus should come here or it has to be like that. It's always been just like, what am I feeling? Very visceral. If when I start thinking to me,
do you find that that's unique or is that?
I don't know if it's unique. It's the only way that I can write. It's the only way that I like to write. And I think the songs and the style of songs a lot have come from the producers and the artists and the time, maybe. Like, so, I mean, I think when we started, we were awesome. We were with EDM producers. And with Julia, I think what I really taught her, and she said this a lot in articles, was she would come in with an idea on a paper. And I was like, let's talk about like what's happening in our lives. And there was always like boy trouble with both of us. And I would be like, let's just both take turns on the mics and just close our eyes and sing stuff. And then we would just like comp it and be like, okay, let's use, I would make a joke and say, we'll comp it. And then we'll use your melodies. Like a lot of times you always used your melodies. And I would do a lot of the lyrics. But now, you know, she's developed her own style, which is very much hers. But I think I helped her and guided her. And that's just what we did. The stuff that we did together was just what we did together. It wasn't like a thinking thing.
Sure. You have in your, I'm just going to the next sort of writing phase, because what's cool about your career is that you've managed to have a lot of songs have been cut by pitching. You're not necessarily in the room all the time with
almost
the artists.
Never. Almost never.
That's super unique for someone to have as long of a discography as yours and to have been with so many different producers and so many different co-writers is pretty unique compared to, it's becoming apparent just from this conversation, because first you look at somebody's discography, but you don't necessarily recognize all the ancillary people who make these songs happen. So it's really fascinating. I mean, you at some point go from Julia to then the next group of people, which is this
new
community of Ian Kirkpatrick, and which I know is all extended family, but Ian and the Monsters and Strangers and Jason Evigan and Sam Martin.
That was the new, well, it sort of happened. Well, and I want to go back to say the only artist I ever wrote a hit in the room with was Nick Lachey, who was part of What's Left of Me. Every other thing was pitched, and then the artist, even with all the Derulo stuff, would come back in later and make it their own.
Right.
But always. It's been, I think, very unusual that way.
Does Dangerous come before Want to Want Me?
Yes.
Okay, so let's go with that first.
Okay.
So is that the first song you wrote with Sam and with...
No.
Ian?
What happened was, Julia and I had gone to this writer's camp in Santa Barbara, and we had such a great time. And so we were working then with Jason and Mitch, and we said, let's do our own writer's camp, Mitch Allen. Yeah. And we decided to also invite Sam Martin, who I think I'd written one song with that nothing happened with it at APG, and Ian Kirkpatrick, who I think I'd written one song with that Julia demoed. And we rented a house in Lake Arrowhead, and the six of us went there, bought our own food, no assistance, no nothing. And we did, I think, about five of these camps. And Want to Want Me was written at one of these camps. And just from, that's how I met those guys and started writing a bunch with those guys. And then I think just from, Dangerous was very lucky for me because Ian and Jason were in the studio. I'll never forget this. And they were like, called me because we had just done a camp. So I was very fresh in their mind. And I mean, yes, I'm a top liner, but I think I'm probably most sought after for lyrics. And they called me, it was like 8 o'clock at night. And I was like, you guys, why are you calling me? You know, I hate to work at night. And they're like, we're just stuck on this lyric. Can you just come over to the studio? And I'm like, fine. They're like, so I just went over there and they had like, just knocked out the lyric. Boom. It was like a
That was a worldwide number one. Just didn't worldwide really number do one. Much in the U.S., but
it was huge. It was just I always say that was one of the luckiest days in my life. That song made up for other songs that, of course, you know, you feel like there are some songs you write a lot of, and the people don't contribute as much or whatever. But this one, I just got lucky that they had, you know, they had the melody and they needed lyrics, and we knocked it out and didn't think anything of it. But I think Want to Want Me was around the same time, because I think there a lot of people wanted to cut that song. Yeah. We had a big battle because Chris Brown really wanted that song. They were going to send a helicopter to bring us to where he was for him to make the changes on it. And then we decided, we always wanted Jason to have it, and then he did his tweaks on it. But
that really helped to redefine him.
I've had so many Jason people. It's like, what's with Jason Derulo?
Well, that,
and Lindy
that
Robin?
Was, I mean,
it's so
that's
funny.
My next thing. You end up with five straight Jason Derulo singles.
I know, and all just coincidental.
As like a white Jewish girl,
I don't understand it. Whenever I see him, we just like hug and we're like, I love you. Like, it's just this weird thing. I mean, It Girl was just, that was a whole other style, but yeah. I mean, Want to Want Me was just one of those songs. And I mean, I have to say that broke Ian, and Ian's production is insane.
Yeah.
And Sam's insane. That was just a great mix of what we all did. And that was a big lesson for me, because this is a funny thing about Want to Want Me. When we were in Lake Arrowhead, the song was called Girl from New York City. Oh, I got a girl in New York City, which I thought was just so cool and clever. And Ian and Sam were like, we need to get back and rewrite that. And Mitch was part of the song too, but they were like, we need to get back and rewrite that. And I'm like, I love it. They're like, it's terrible. So when I came up with the lyric Want to Want Me, I thought that was just so terrible. Coming from where I'd started and Skyscraper and Audrey McDonald, and I was just like, it's so, and Sam was like, no, it's great. So it was a lesson in, you know, in simplicity of that lyric. And the right melody. That song was a big lesson for me. And
being conversational in pop,
yes,
is a whole other thing than being conversational in theater. Because, you know, you go to a theater, you have to walk away singing the song, and every lyric has to tell part of the story, or it's just down. If you go and you sing Want to Want Me in the middle of a musical, it would just sound weird. But you go seeing Girl in, you know, I'm in love with a girl in New York City, could totally be just an incredible, you see that song.
Well,
and Want to Want Me is an emotion, and it's a feeling.
I learned a huge lesson from that song, and I have to really credit Sam and Ian, because they really drilled it in my head, and I like finally got it. Like, I got, even though I've never, like I said, been a thinking writer, it sort of changed something in me of saying, okay, like the conversational and certain Mike Caron rules that you talked about in the Mike Caron interview. It was a good lesson of the difficulty of simplicity.
Sure.
And setting up the picture and the furniture in the verses. I mean, we spent a long time in that song. I mean, usually songs fly out of me very quickly.
How do you feel about when Cheyenne comes out following just a giant smash like Want to Want Me? Cheyenne, Try Me, and If It Ain't Love are all, well, If It Ain't Love is
mid-charters
the next thing.
Mid-charters at best.
Yeah. Like, how does that affect you as a writer? Or is there sort of like, none of this matters because Want to Want Me is like,
I've always fly by the seat of my pants. I mean, none of those songs were even written, like, you know, I was really lucky that I was Monsters and Strangers. It was the same thing. If It Ain't Love, that Jason called me, like, we're stuck on a lyric. Can you come to the studio? Cheyenne was an accident of us just like it being around Christmas time. And there were like seven of us there. And we're like, let's just all write the song together. Just for fun. Let's just write a song and see what happens. But no, I think I'm just not I don't think about stuff like that. So I wasn't watching things like, oh my God, this has to be a hit. Like I think, or maybe I'm fortunate enough that I'm at the point now where I think Want to Want Me put me in a new position that I'm extremely grateful for, where I don't quite have to worry as much. I mean, I want to still be relevant. I mean, I have a song coming out on Andra Day that I'm extremely proud of, which I feel is going, it's a song called Amen that I can't wait for everybody to hear.
You've heard
that song. Yeah. So I think this may be another new era, and I've started to go back to Nashville. Like I started to, you know, and going to London more and something, fingers crossed on, well, we'll see, other credible artists that I've been coming kind of back into that now.
Yeah.
I've sort of not gone full circle, but just kind of wanting to write more sophisticated lyrics again. But I'm open for anything. Like, I'm always up for anything, and I think that's part of my longevity. It's like, I love writing fun pop songs. I can't wait for rock to come back. I love going to Nashville. I still love, you know, soul, R&B, you don't really call it, or rhythmic. I don't do, like, really urban songs. That's the only thing that I don't do.
But it should explain to people how valuable somebody who writes lyrics is, and they're somebody who's willing to also evolve with time, because lyrics, you know, you're not writing songs right now talking about shorty this, shorty that. Do you know what I mean?
You have to listen to, like you were talking about conversational. There was a time where stuff was more poetic.
Right.
And now songs are very conversational. And I think you have to follow your own heart and be willing to start the new trend, but you also want to listen to what's out there and hopefully be inspired and influenced by it.
Well, we've worked with a lot of producers, and a lot of producers in your discography who had moments because that sound was so relevant at that time, and it just takes so much effort to move the needle sonically, and a lot of people just don't. You get comfortable, and you don't have the same drive you had when you're living in a place for $300 a month, and you know, eating spaghetti and ragu. It's hard to convince somebody who lives in a nice house in the hills to like keep struggling to find that drum sound.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I agree. I think sometimes top liners have a better shot at longevity because we can just always be with the new producers or the new artists, and what we do is kind of what we do. It's the sonics and the landscape that make it sound current.
Yeah.
I think more than anything. But I've never lost my drive to create. I've lost a little bit of the desperation because I think, you know, being Jewish, we always have to be a little bit desperate. Do they like me? Are they going to call me? Do they still like me? But I still have this huge, like yesterday, I was so excited about the song I wrote yesterday because it was something that was inspired by real life events. And I was like bursting to write this song.
Love it.
Yeah, and I just still feel like there's so much in me that wants to be expressed. And that's what it's always been.
I know in the last year you had some really interesting things happen also, where you had, you know, a Eurovision song.
Well, that was just like, that was crazy. It's a song that I wrote at the French Castle like 5 years ago. That was just a matter of me, of a publisher, one of my publishers, Cobalt Smanche in Berlin saying, send me everything and song, just everything I could think of. I just sent, and they just happened to pick this song. That
That's a different thing that people don't know what that is in the U.S. Can you explain what Eurovision is?
Well, it's a massive, it is a song contest.
Yeah,
but it's also about
like
an art. It's both about an artist and a song. I mean, it's beyond massive.
It's almost like Formula One is outside of the U.S. or soccer is outside of the U.S. It's so big that it's hard to explain what it is.
Yeah.
That when the winner of Eurovision happens, it's on the cover of every newspaper throughout the world except for the U.S.
It's like American Idol times 1,000. It's hard. Yeah, it's massive.
Were there opportunities because of that have arisen, or is that more just,
well,
that was just a cool thing to witness?
You know, what it is that because of that, and because Dangerous was so big in Germany, like I'm going to be going to Berlin to do some writing. So it just gives me a bit of a presence in Berlin. I have a presence in London. I have, you know, a couple things happening in Nashville. So those things are important to just keep you relevant in different territories, because I really, really enjoy traveling and writing trips. I find it very inspiring, and I've had, it's just fun and great things. Like my two loves.
Well, that's why you do this anyway, though.
Yes,
to experience life in a unique way.
Yes, I love going into a room and spending the day with people that I like and eating lunch and creating. Like, I feel so grateful. I mean, I'm not. I really, really do all the time. That I get to do it still, and that people still are calling. I mean, are there hotter, shinier new pennies? Hell yeah. But, you know, if you want, like, tried and true, it's like, call Indy.
I like that. That's awesome. That should be your theme song. It's like 1-888-1-888.
1-888-CALL-INDY.
I'm going to list five people, and just tell me what comes, the first thing that comes to your head.
Okay.
Jason Derulo.
Money in the Bank. Thank you, Jason.
Love that.
An incredible voice and falsetto.
Let's go back and do Audra McDonald.
Just tears from her talent. And yeah.
Her music
director. She moves me. I've seen her on stage. She moves me.
Her music director is my cousin. It's the only other musician in my entire family is a guy named Ted Sperling.
I know Ted Sperling because he was part of the Rodgers and Hammerstein family when I had my deal there.
He is my...
We're related anyway,
We're related. That's pretty cool because I've always said that. I've said, you know, the only other person in my family has won multiple Tony Awards, the only other musician in my family. And, we know each other peripherally, but not really. And it's just sort of one of those things of when you view something as attainable, you reach for it. So if you think that you can try to win Tonys, then you go, okay, well,
exactly.
Then
that's why I was writing those songs back then, because those were the people I knew. And I've always been one to say the opportunities that I have, whether it's dance, country, or whatever.
Let's go with the E-Man and Evan Bogart.
Lunch, number one. Lunch, laughing and torturing me. By
lunch.
Putting just like the brothers that tease you more than ever, and talent, and just craziness.
Yeah.
Like zaniness.
Yeah. I'll go with this. I got to go the whole crew. I got to go Ian, Monsters and Strangers, Jason Evigan and Sam Martin.
You know, challenging in a good way, because Sam and Ian, especially because I wrote a lot of songs with them, they pushed me to change the way that I wrote, and I'm stubborn. So did E-Man and Evan in a different way, actually. But it just changed. They changed me in a good way, and they challenged me, and sometimes I wanted to kill them. And I love them so much for that.
I'll
tell Ian that
when I see him in 45 minutes.
Yes.
I'm going to be like, you know what Lindy said?
And love, and so much, they give me so much love. I mean that genuinely, all these people.
They're fantastic. This is that
real love.
The generation thing that we talk about a lot, where this is a different generation in the music business. You know, there is a lot more emotion in this. It feels like everyone's much more familial. And I mean, I was in bed, my wife's asleep, and I'm on a text chain with Ian and Jay Cash last night. At till like 12:30, making jokes, which I can't say.
But of course,
you know, it's the fact that it's a different generation. There is genuine love throughout the whole community.
All of them,
a big part of it.
Yeah, and things that aren't about music. Like Jason Evigan and I, like, we just, you know, these really deep, we have these deep spiritual conversations, and just, you know, and Ian and I would just be like, I love you, I miss you. I mean, there's real love. Sam also, like, there's real love and friendship and support for success that we have with other people that I think is really, really nice.
Totally.
You know?
All right, last one, I gotta say, Julia Michaels.
Okay, it's bittersweet. Mostly, I'm so proud of her. I think that she's an astonishing talent. I really had a huge part in her breaking through, her first opportunities, bringing her to her manager, getting her first cuts. But mostly it's pride that I really just showed her that she could do what she already knew what to do. Because her style is her own style. Like, nobody else does that. And I think what I did was just give her the confidence to just do what she does that nobody else does. So, and I miss her. You know, she's partnered up with Justin, and she's, you know, we've all moved on to our other things. I mean, when I see her, it's a love fest. But so, a little bittersweet, but mostly just incredible pride. And
I love that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for doing this. You know, the industry is filled with those people who do come in and are a shiny new penny who, you know, you leave them on a sidewalk after a while. You know, it's just sort of what it is. And you have all these people who come in with ulterior motives, who want to be famous, who want to do all these different things. Maybe they're trendy, all these things that get them in the door, but don't keep them in the room. And for you to continue to, you're in so many rooms. Any one of these co-writers would welcome you back into their room. All you have to do is be like, hey, what are you doing?
I write with a lot of them still. Yeah, I write with Toby, I write with E-Man and Evan, Ian, Sam,
but
Jason.
That says a lot because they can easily say no. They could easily go and move on. They could find another penny to go right with, but they don't. They still are just like, no. If Jason Derulo is hitting you up and Audra McDonald can hit you up, you know, if you can go and have that career, I'm pretty sure as a writer there, you can't have a more successful kind of discography and experience traveling the world doing music and Eurovision that was written in a castle in France. It just sounds fake. It sounds like you're making this up as you go, but you're not. You're just nice and you're fun to spend time with, and so people want to write with you, and you're it's fortunate that you're also good. So congratulations on everything, and thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to David Silberstein from Mega House Music and Michael White. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.